The Lara Murphy Show, episode 47.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone. We're back for another episode of the Lara Murphy Show, and this time it actually is both Lara and Murphy, in contrast to the last episode that I just did a solo in terms of Bitcoin. So we're back in the saddle. Carlos, how's things up in Nashville?
They're good, Bob. I hope you're doing good.
I am. Busy as always, which is a good thing. So we just got back, folks, from the IBC Think Tank, which is the annual meeting of IBC authorized practitioners. And this time they were allowed to bring invited guests. And it was a great event. There was some karaoke, also very eventful and exciting. And I thought what we should do maybe, Carlos, is just explain briefly the talks that we gave at the Think Tank, because I know I really liked your – it was arguably the best talk I've ever seen you give in terms of just you really grabbed the crowd. And so
thank you.
Take a few minutes. If you want to take a few minutes and maybe just tell the folks at home who missed it. You know, what's the big fuss about here?
Well, you know what? It really was a great event. And I always enjoy going to an IBC think tank. There's always a tremendous amount of energy in the air at these things. Obviously, we've got a lot of speakers that are just anxious to share with the audience all the things that they've prepared, you know, in their talks. And of course, they're rehearsing these things in their head the whole time. So a lot of the energy comes from that. But then the audience, too, is there to hear these great things that these people are going to talk about. And of course, the main story is IBC. And like I like to tell people that IBC is still the best kept secret in America. And not only in America, but also in Canada and really anywhere in the world where the dividend paying whole life policy can be obtained. So the event was, I think, one of the best we've had, Bob. We had great attendance. This time we invited guests to come, you know, to the event. Like if they knew a practitioner and practitioner, you know, brought them as a guest. So we had a lot of people that were in the audience that were not authorized IBC practitioners. And so it made for a great conference. So with regards to the opening talk, which I gave, actually, I pulled it from, as I said, the annals of Austrian economics, probably the greatest speech that's ever been delivered to fellow Austrians. And it's the speech that Henry Hazlitt gave at the occasion of his 70th birthday in New York City.
Let me just, I think probably most of our listeners know, but Henry Hazlitt, of course, among his other accomplishments, is the author of Economics in One Lesson, which I think many people have probably at least heard of, which is, for a lot of people, they could say, yeah, that was the book that really taught me what I call free market economics. So this is the Hazlitt Carlos is talking about.
Yeah, and he's really one of my favorites, actually, of all the Austrian greats, American-born. And everybody knows him because, you know, he has these affiliations with these great newspaper publications, you know, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, back when they were really good newspapers. But, of course, his big blockbuster book was Economics in One Lesson, as you said, and what a great book that is. But anyway, it was the occasion of that speech that had so many interesting things in it. And of course, I'm speaking to authorized IBC practitioners who I consider to be fellow Austrians because, as you know, our practitioner program for financial professionals teaches the financial professionals the basics of Austrian economics. This makes us very unique, you know, in the financial services industry, that we incorporate that part in our teaching, in our manual, in addition to the theory of IBC. The integration of those two subjects is makes it, you know, very unique. But what was interesting about that talk is that every time I hear it, it just motivates me. And as I was telling the audience there, that one year in particular, the earlier part of 2008, I had read that particular speech, and it motivated me so much that I went after you in trying to convert you to IBC. That's how much it has always moved me. Because
hey, so can I stop? This is just to make sure I understand. So for the folks at home, and Carlos and I talked about this in the opening episodes of the Laura Murphy Show, about how I was in Nashville at the time. Carlos was reading one of my study guides, I think, to Rothbard. So I was in Nashville. We started talking, and then he gave me Nelson Nash's book, and then over time kind of sucked me into IBC, if you will. But are you saying this wasn't just a habit? Like, that was kind of your mission?
It became my mission because of the
things. I did not know that.
Well, because of the things that Henry Hazlitt is saying in this speech. You know, ironically, it's a very pessimistic speech. I mean, he's lamenting in the speech over the fact that he's spent, virtually his entire life, you know, trying to spread the freedom message. And he says to himself, and what have I really accomplished? You know, socialism is more pronounced than it's ever been. I mean, they've already taken over Europe, and now it's fast encroaching on the United States. And so he's kind of like sad that the freedom message is literally being snuffed out. And so here he is, he's 70 years old, and he's talking about personal discouragement in that arena, you see. But in spite of that, at the end of the speech, he really lifts everyone by the hope that he ends the speech with. Very, very positive ending to the speech. And in fact, it's in the book that you and I wrote, Bob. It's on page 16. I put a part of that speech in there simply because it's a very stirring speech. And so I put it there in the introduction because it was to emphasize the absolute need for the building of the 10%. You know, we absolutely need to change public opinion. And here's Hazlitt kind of rousing the troops. And so I'm telling the practitioners that were there at the think tank that at the time of that speech, there was probably no more than 50 people in the room at that time. And it was probably the entirety of the Austrian School of Economics. And when you stop to think about the way Austrian economics has spread, you know, not only worldwide, but, you know, just the growth that it's had since that particular evening when he delivered that talk, which was over 53 years ago. I mean, it's incredible. But in the room was a very small crowd. And I was letting the practitioners know, because here they are, they're gathered at the think tank, and it's almost like saying, you know, we've got this powerful message of IBC. We've got this powerful message of Austrian economics. And all you need to do is think about what all we can do if we start spreading this message. So that was the whole idea of the talk, Bob. But
well, can you? The thing I really liked though was the little detour you took through the scene from 1984 that I guess Hazlitt alluded to.
Oh yes, yes. Well. What's incredible is that once I told people who was actually in the room, you know, F.A. Hyatt was in the room, and this was before he won the Nobel Prize, you know, for the Austrian business cycle theory, which happened 10 years later, okay, because the date of this thing was 1964. Also in the room was Leonard Reed. Now, that's, of course, we all know was Nelson Nash's mentor and friend. He would actually meet Reed 2 years later in 1966. Ron Paul was not in the room, and neither was Nelson Nash. Nash would have been about 33 years old at the time.
Yeah, I joked with Nelson at the think tank. I said, how come you weren't at Hazlitt's birthday party? And he kind of chuckled.
Yeah, so, and Bob, you weren't there.
No, hadn't even I had a pretty good excuse. Yeah. I was not yet a fetus.
Yeah. And so anyway, the point was, is that these greats were there. And of course, the old man himself was in there. I mean, he would have been 84 at the time. I'm talking about Mises himself was there in the room. But the reason I started talking about this 1984 thing was because Hazlitt did something very unique. He used the occasion of his own birthday and his own speech to not only encourage his fellow Austrians, but also to chastise them. And the way he did it was by using this particular section of the book, 1984, which was a very dark book and a very pessimistic kind of book. But he used one section of the book in there talking about one of the main heroes of the book was this guy named Winston Smith, and he's not necessarily a brilliant guy or a courageous guy. He's just an average person. But this fellow, Winston Smith, has been keeping this secret diary. And in this secret diary, he's written the words that freedom is the freedom to say that two and two makes four. And so what happens is that the party, you know, finds this secret diary, and the inquisitor of the party, this guy named O'Brien, is questioning Winston Smith over this diary, and he's got Winston Smith on some sort of a torture rack. And if he moves the lever a certain way, I mean, he can really extract some excruciating pain on Winston Smith. And he even tells Winston, he says, you know, I can move this lever just a little bit this way, and it'll completely, you know, break your backbone. And so then he actually starts to, you know, move that lever and slowly, you know, is putting this tremendous pain on Winston Smith, and then he holds up his left hand with four fingers, and he says, how many fingers am I holding up? And so Winston Smith says, he knows that he's supposed to say five, but of course he can't say five, he can only say four, and so he says four. And so this fellow O'Brien, you know, increases the pain, starts moving the lever with more intensity. And he says, think again, Winston, how many fingers am I holding up? And Winston again says, four. And so again, more pain, and again, more pain. And Winston, you know, just keeps saying four, four, four. And of course, you know, eventually the pain gets so excruciating that, you know, he finally gives in, but not before he puts up one hell of a fight. And of course, this is where Hazlitt steps in, and he's telling his fellow Austrians, he says, you know, we're not on a torture rack, and none of us are in jail. And, you know, we're getting all these abusive and aggravations, and people are calling us dirty names. But, you know, all we really have at risk is our reputation. You know, so if we're not in that situation like a Winston Smith, then we surely, you know, can develop the courage to be able to stand up and say that 2 + 2 = 4. And so his whole message is very rousing in trying to let his fellow Austrians know that, you know, that this is what we're meant to do. This is what we're called to do, you know, to keep spreading the freedom message. But then what's interesting is he telling them that that's not all what the problem is. And again, this is 1964, and Hazlitt's saying, you know, every leftist in America right now is calling himself a liberal. And what's ironic about that, we're the liberals. You know, we're the ones that want limited government. We're the ones that want, you know, freedom for the individual. We're the ones that want free trade, free markets, free enterprise, you know, private property as the means of production. You know, we're the ones that want capitalism, and we're against socialism. So he says, you know, why is it? Why is it that we're so ineffective? Why isn't our freedom message spreading? You know, so anyway, I'm going on maybe further than you wanted me to, but that was the essence of the speech, Bob.
Yeah, it was great stuff, and lots of nuggets in there. I mean, it was interesting because I remember I think Ronald Reagan had some kind of quote, like I got a book one time when I was younger about, you know, the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan or something back when I was a good right winger. And he said something like, freedom is the freedom to be stupid if you want to, or something like that. And so it was funny, the contrast between that versus, you know, in other words, Reagan was like saying, you know, get away from paternalistic government and don't let the nanny state in Washington tell you what to do. If you want to not wear a seatbelt or eat fast food or whatever, you should be able to. And that is true, but it seemed more powerful that the scene from 1984 that you relayed, that, you know, Winston writing in his diary, freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4. Like that really, for some reason to me, seemed like it was much more important that what we're doing here is just saying things that are obviously true. And that's really what the regime has to stamp out of you. And, you know, I've been, Carl's listening to Jordan Peterson a lot, and his big, I'm sure a lot of people in our audience have heard his name or whatever, but the thing he stresses a lot in his lectures to the public is that part of the dysfunction of what happened in these totalitarian regimes, and here Peterson's just repeating the things that, you know, he's read other people who lived through it, and what they reported was that, like, the whole society just had to start systematically lying. So, for example, if conditions were miserable in Soviet Russia, the people still, like, you'd get in trouble if you complained about anything, you know, because that would hurt the image of communism as liberating the common man and so forth. And so you just had to go through your daily life pretending to everybody that things were great, even though they were miserable. And Jordan Peterson is saying, like, that the need to lie like that is just what made everybody kind of go nuts. And so anyway, I think that scene you described from 1984 really hits the essence of it. And I was getting pumped up in the crowd just listening to it.
Well, the book, if you remember, was a prophecy on the future, you know, a totalitarian, you know, future. And so it was, Hazlitt did a wonderful job in what he did with that. And of course, you know, in the end, there toward the end of the speech, he's basically saying that we can't, if we hope to convince the majority, we can't be as good as the majority. We have to be better than the majority. And that was the part that I really wanted to get across to even our own practitioners. We've got to be better, you know, and it's because we're a minority to start with that it puts even more pressure on us to even really be better, because we are such a minority. I mean, our voices get drowned out by all the noise. So anyway, I just love that talk. It starts off rather pessimistic with Hazlitt lamenting the way he does, but man, does it end with a power. It's a powerful talk. And I think it motivated everybody that was there, including myself.
Yeah, that's always good when you pump yourself up. It's sort of like when I'm writing articles for the Laura Murphy Report and I end up scaring myself by the end of them. It's like, geez, I'm just laying out these statistics. The financial sector is in trouble. Well, that's so thank you for relaying that. And again, it was, I think it could possibly be the best speech I've seen you give. And I know I had people afterwards telling me like, oh, wow, Carlos was really on fire today. As far as what did I talk about? Hey, let's talk about me.
Okay.
For those of you who subscribe to the Laura Murphy Report, you've seen me already cover this material. I did a quick thing on the yield curve. And so for those of you, probably most of our listeners is rooted in the financial sector, vaguely have heard about this at the very least. But the idea is when the yield curve inverts, for whatever reason, it signifies an impending recession. So the yield curve is just showing on the x-axis, there's the length to maturity. You know, is it a 3-month bond, a 6-month, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, that sort of thing. And then the y-axis is the annualized yield. And so normally in the 20th century and beyond, it was an upward sloping yield curve was the typical thing. So the yield on a 30-year treasury would be higher than the yield on a 3-month T-bill. But yet there are periods where that would flip, where short-term rates would be higher than long-term rates. And for whatever reason, it's a well-documented fact that at least going back to like the 50s, when the yield curve would invert for a sufficiently long duration, it was always followed by a recession. And then the opposite held as well, that if there ever were a recession, you could always look behind it and see that there had been an inversion of the yield curve. So anyway, that's a fact that people in the financial markets know, and that's relevant now because in 2018, as short rates are coming up, they're getting closer to the long-term rate, and people are wondering, oh, gee, is the yield curve going to invert this year? And what does that mean? Is there going to be another recession? So what I just pointed out to the crowd is I showed them that mainstream economists, I don't think, really have satisfactorily explained why this pattern exists. They basically try to say, well, the people in the bond market collectively know that a recession's coming, and so then by them acting on that and adjusting their intertemporal flows of consumption and income, it ends up causing the yield curve to invert. And so I just pointed out that's kind of weird. They're basically, these mainstream economists are basically saying, oh, yeah, the people in the bond market know a recession's coming. So then when they act on that projection, market prices adjust such that everyone looking now at those prices say, oh, a recession's coming. But it's like the people know a recession's coming, and then they look at the results of their activity and they say, ah, recession's coming. But they kind of already knew that going into it. So that just to me seemed a little bit circular. In contrast, if you independently already believe in Austrian business cycle theory, well, then this pattern makes perfect sense. Because remember, Austrian theory says, oh, there's an unsustainable boom caused by artificially cheap credit that pushes down interest rates below the market level where they should be, or the natural level, if you want to use that terminology, causes an unsustainable boom. Then the central bank chickens out. It stops inflating so much, interest rates shoot up, and there's a crash. So, you know, just decompose that a little bit. Okay, in reality, there's not just the interest rate, but there's many interest rates of different maturities and different kinds of bonds with different, you know, risk profiles and whatever. So when we say the central bank pushes down the interest rate during the boom and jacks up the interest rate when it gets, you know, nervous and causes a bust, that's actually more of the short-term rates, that the Fed has much more control over the 3-month T-bill rather than the 30-year bond. And so my point was, look at the historical pattern here showing short and long rates and recessions. And you can see when the yield curve inverts, it's not because long bond yields come way down and go below the short one. It's the other way around. It's that the short rate zooms up and then overshoots, and that's why the yield curve inverts. So again, it totally fits in. This quote, normal time when the yield curve is upward sloping is when the Fed's pumping in money, keeping interest rates, short-term interest rates, low, so that causes the unsustainable boom. Then when the Fed chickens out, interest rates shoot up. It's actually short rates shooting up, and they zoom up above even the long rate, So the yield curve inverts. So that's always going to go hand in hand with right when the Fed is tightening after an unsustainable boom. So that's why the recession happens. So anyway, I just thought that was a neat little thing. I'm actually trying to write that up for an academic journal to see if I can get that in a regular kind of, you know, mainstream finance journal or something, just to show, hey, look at Austrian business cycle theory has this explanatory power behind it to bring something to the, you know, mainstream economics. So that's what I did.
Hey, Bob, I wonder if I could get us to loop around a little bit on the back end of that explanation and talk a little bit about what actually happened, you know, the week of this think tank, in that we had 2 days in which the stock market really plunged pretty deeply. And that was, you know, on the other side of it really plunging in the same way on that Friday before. And a couple of things that I want to mention about that was that I remember in 1987, Black Monday, it was about a 500-point drop. And I mean to tell you, it really frightened people when it happened. And it was the largest drop in the stock market in history, you know, up to that point. And I've noticed that these drops were even bigger. There seems to be not as much fear, you know, in the general populace over the way the stock market dropped the way it did. And I wonder if we could talk a little about that. Why is it that somehow you didn't get the same kind of reaction? I mean, are they getting desensitized to this sort of thing? What is the problem there? Now, I did notice that there was a major sell-off of bonds during that period of time that took place. And I guess it's because there's legitimate fears of the interest rates climbing now. And I think that we're going to continue to see that. So even though the stock market leveled off again, I don't think people need to get too comfortable that things are somehow fixed and that perhaps maybe this is going to really lay us out for a much bigger problem down the road. What do you think?
Well, yeah. So a few comments on that. So one thing is in terms of the difference between the absolute point drop versus the percentage point drop. So you're right. In 87, when that happened, it was both the biggest point drop and the biggest percentage drop in history. Now, the ones that recently happened, you're right, we had the biggest point drop in history, you know, in other words, setting a new record. But because the Dow or the S&P, whichever one you're looking at, is so much higher in absolute terms, the percentage drop that we just experienced wasn't nearly as big as what happened. You know, so the 1987 one-day drop is still the record for, you know, the biggest percentage drop. So that's one reason. But I think you're right, too, that beyond that, for some reason, people now have this notion that, oh, with all its new tools and everything and central bankers, they're just much more adept at navigating these choppy waters. And, you know, they really wouldn't let the market just crash. They would come in and pump it back up or something. So I think you're right that people do have this touching faith in the power of central bankers to do these things. As far as, yeah, the bond market, I mean, here I'm just recapitulating what the standard story was, that remember there had been that robust wage growth report that came out the Friday before the think tank occurred this year. And so I think people said, because wage growth now is really starting to pick up, the Fed's going to have to go ahead and raise rates the way it's been hinting it might have to. And so then it was just giving more certainty that interest rates were rising. And then, yeah, that would cause a sell-off in the bond market, and it caused stock prices to come down, even just for normal, quote, fundamental reasons. If you're viewing a stock as a claim on future dividend flows or even capital gains from the stock price, you know, those things get the higher the interest rate you're using to discount those future flows, that implies a lower present value. So that's, again, why if interest rates all shoot up, you could imagine stock prices dropping.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the flip side of saying, if we thought it was artificially cheap credit that helped blow up the stock bubble, well then, duh, when they start raising rates again, that's going to deflate the bubble.
Right.
Well, Carlos, if only there were like a short little booklet people could get their hands on that would help make sense of all this stuff, or at least give them a way out, you know? Wouldn't that be great?
That would be fantastic. You got such a thing?
Well, it's funny you ask. I do. So the other thing, folks, that happened at the think tank in 2018 that was quite special is we formally launched our new book called The Case for IBC. So we're already short on time for this particular episode. We'll just tease you a little bit, but we plan on having a whole series of podcast episodes devoted to each chapter of this new book. So what it is, it's, as the case suggests, we came out, it's Carlos, Nelson Nash, and I are the official authors. David Stearns also had a huge role to play in this. We've been going around the country putting on the IBC seminar for the general public. Many of you have seen it. And I realized at one point, I'm going to take credit for this one, Carlos, that I said, you know what? There's a lot of original material that we have all developed for presentation in this seminar that we don't have in any of our written materials. And I thought, in case one of us gets hit by a bus or something, we better write this stuff down. And so that's what this book is. It's the distillation of this seminar that we had developed, like sort of a road show, if you will, where we went around presenting IBC to people who had possibly never heard it before. We didn't want to assume anything, so we start from scratch. So in my opinion, this is now the single best starting point for IBC, because we do things like even teach people how do you read a life insurance illustration. So I say, of course, this isn't a substitute or replacement for becoming your own banker. We give more of the history of sound money and privatized banking in our other book, How Privatized Banking Really Works. But this book, if you just say, you know what, I'm curious, but what the heck is IBC and why do I want to go down this path of study? This is now the one that I would put into people's hands. You any thoughts you want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, well, I think we really distilled this thing down about as good as we could. And, you know, we're using an example in this book. That's how we start off, that it's looking at the thing from the eyes of a business owner, even though, as you know, running a business is not much different than running a household. But it's the whole idea that we're starting out with the view of this thing from a business owner and recognizing the stranglehold that business owners can get into in just dealing with the commercial banking system. And so it's this whole idea of creating an alternate bank. But quite frankly, I think we did a good job by starting out with that example, simply because I think a lot of business owners can relate to this. And also, it's good for the general public to understand that all of us as depositors in commercial banks, that the whole thing's gotten a lot riskier than it's ever been. And so it's driving that point across pretty good. And we're starting off with that. You know what it kind of reminds me of, to be honest with you, is the way Henry Hazlitt did Economics in One Lessons, where he started out with an example of the broken window. And he hammered that point all the way through the book, and it penetrated. You know, it got through to the masses, you know, just so that people weren't being bored to death over economic, long-winded explanation of things. That example of the broken window, you know, was able to penetrate that mind of the masses and did a beautiful job. I think, in a sense, we've done something very similar here by describing the stranglehold of business owners and really the public in general in dealing with commercial banks. What do you think? That's kind of the way I'm looking at it. I think it's a great book because of the way it does that.
Well, yeah, you're certainly right that what makes this book unique is it does present IBC from the point of view of the business owner. And as Carlos said, for various reasons, I think it really clicks there because, you know, the business owner is really concerned about cash flow.
Right.
And one way we've taken to describing what IBC is, just when somebody says, what the heck, what is it? You say, well, it's a cash flow management system. And so naturally that resonates with business owners. Not to say that if you just run a regular household and you're a salaried employee, IBC still makes sense for you too. But we've just found you can really get it across to people by looking at it from the perspective of a business owner. And so why would a business owner really want to get into IBC?
Right. And you know what? I do want to thank, while we still have time, because I do see that our time is starting to escape from us, all the people that came from so many different places, from hearing on this show that we were going to be in Birmingham to do the IBC seminar. It was so nice to meet so many of you that did come out. I really enjoyed visiting with you, and it was just a great feeling to know that you would take the time to come out, you know, and from far distances to come. So, Bob, we need to make sure that as we continue with this roadshow, that we let people know, you know, in what city we're going to be in next. I'd like to, you know, be able to meet more and more of our listeners if possible.
Yeah, definitely. We will keep all of you informed of that. So for now, let us just leave you with the website. We've got a website now devoted to the new book called thecaseforibc.com. So go ahead and go to that and you will see how to get the book. And as I say, we will be spending the next several episodes just going through chapter by chapter and expounding upon the book. But you're going to want to get the book beforehand and read it to be able to follow along. So everybody, that's what you do right now. If you want to like go eat lunch or something first, you can do that. But before the day is over, you really want to go ahead and order this book and get it in the mail. Any parting words for the listeners, Carlos?
Well, I'm just wanting everybody to read the book because I think it'll help them. It'll help, free you, move you into a very financial, stress-free way of living, and it'll encourage you to spread the message on to others.
Very motivational, Carlos. And remember, if you don't want to be tortured by O'Brien, you want to get this book. That's really what we're saying. Okay, thanks everyone for listening, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.